It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The Milwaukee Bucks have traded superstar Giannis Antetokounmpo to the Miami Heat in a blockbuster deal that marks the end of an era for Wisconsin's NBA team.
Antetokounmpo and forward Bobby Portis are headed to Miami. The team will receive four players and a bunch of draft picks and swaps in return.
Antetokounmpo is the most accomplished player in Bucks history, leading the team in multiple stats, including points, assists, rebounds, blocks, and steals. He led the team to an NBA championship in 2021, the second in franchise history.
Eric Naim is a senior writer for The Athletic, covering the Milwaukee Bucks. Eric, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
It feels like we've been on Giannis watch for months, years. It feels like decades, honestly, Eric. But this time it seemed like it was going to be inevitable. It was going to happen. Why now?
I think it just got to a point where the organization for years had made the priority. They just prioritized the idea that we are going to do everything in our power to compete for championships with Giannis Antetokounmpo as our best player. And to do that, they needed to trade a lot of draft picks, and they needed to trade away a lot of young players, and they needed to keep doing things that brought stars into Milwaukee so that Giannis would want to stay, that Giannis felt as though the team could compete. And I think they had the wherewithal right now to do it. You know, they had three first-round picks that they could have gone down that path one more time. And I think with the injuries that Giannis has suffered over the years, I think with his age, with next year being his 14th season, I think they just got to a spot where they did not believe it was prudent any longer to go down that path and to keep trying to extract a little bit more out of their contention window and instead try to make something that prioritized their future a little bit more and try to get them back to a healthier place as an organization. And that was ultimately trading Giannis Antetokounmpo. And I think in kind of coordination, conjunction with that is, you know, Giannis had, you know, signaled behind the scenes, or his representation at least had signaled that he wasn't really going to be willing to sign another long-term extension in the city of Milwaukee. And he would have been able to do that on October 1st. This would have been the last year of his contract in Milwaukee. And I think the Bucks, hearing that, couldn't risk the idea that if we make one more desperation move and Giannis does not like it, we can't risk him just walking out of Milwaukee at the end of the season and us not getting anything for him. So they decided to make the move and move on and kind of end the Giannis Antetokounmpo era.
And Eric, you just talked about the Bucks' motivations and this concept. I think that it's clear that the Bucks are not going to win another championship while Giannis is still playing. From the Giannis Antetokounmpo perspective, it seems like it was clear to him that, hey, if I want to win another championship, it's not going to be with the Bucks. Do I have that about right?
Yeah, I think those things could always change, right? But I think when it became clear that the Bucks were not going to make any more of those moves, that, you know, they weren't going to trade their first round picks at the trade deadline, and they weren't going to trade their first round picks when this offseason started, that they kind of just got to a spot where it, from his perspective, it didn't appear as though the organization, despite hiring a new coach, and I think he believes a lot in Taylor Jenkins, the roster just wasn't going to need to be where it needed to be to get him into position to win another championship. And I think that might have been a challenge or something that was interesting, you know, a mountain to climb, let's say, when he was younger. But now that he's gotten a little bit older, I don't know that he can do it in the same way. And I think this season was a bit of that realization that, you know, even when he was healthy and he was playing, it was a lot to try to get this team in position to win games. And it's a little bit harder to do when, you know, you're 31 years old as opposed to when you're 21 years old or you're 25 years old.
You mentioned new coach Taylor Jenkins, and from the outside, it might look like, well, gosh, this is a big rug pull for this fella. He's thinking he's coming in and coaching Giannis. He isn't. What do we understand about the expectations that the club were setting him up for?
Yeah, I think I think his contract and the length of it, you know, it's 6 years long. It pays him, you know, somewhere near the top five salaries of coaches in the NBA. I've long thought of it as a bit of a tax to the Bucks that, you know, they couldn't guarantee to Taylor Jenkins that Giannis was gonna be on the team. And maybe they had already even told Taylor, like, hey, Giannis not gonna be on the team. We're gonna do this rebuilding thing. And I think the tax that they paid was a longer contract and a bigger contract to give Taylor that security to know that, hey, if this is going to be more of a rebuilding situation, we got your back. We believe in you. We want you here. We believe you're the kind of guy that can develop players and build us up back into the team that we want to be, if that's the path that we end up going down, or if, you know, we trade for a guy like Jaylen Brown that the Celtics had put on the table for Giannis, that they could also win with Taylor Jenkins. So to me, I don't think Taylor would necessarily be surprised with all of this. You know, the Bucks made sure to go down to Memphis, where he previously resided, very early in this process, you know, just 2 days after the regular season was done. Ownership was down there. They met with him and his family for a long time. I think all of those questions would have been answered for Taylor. And I don't think this would have necessarily come as a surprise. Obviously, I think he would have loved the opportunity to coach one of the best players in the world. But I don't think it was a surprise to him that that might not end up being the case.
Talking to Eric Name with The Athletic, covering the Milwaukee Bucks, looking at the end of the Giannis Antetokounmpo era in Milwaukee. A quick look at that future for the Bucks now. There are lots of draft picks, not just this year, but numbers starting with 2030, 2031 draft picks. This is a future-oriented, a rebuilding-oriented trade, it looks like.
Yeah, I think it's tough to kind of square up the complete picture, just because the Bucks don't have control of their draft picks until 2030. So it is a right now, because of all the win now trades that they had made with Giannis, you know, they did all of that and kind of stripped down all their draft picks. So now you get out to 2030, where a lot of those picks come in. Obviously, there's one tonight, which is nice for the Bucks, number 13 in this year's draft. So the Bucks will have 10 and 13 tonight in the first round of the NBA draft. But to go from, you know, this year trying to figure out what they're going to do, rebuilding, trying to figure out who some players are going to be, develop those guys, all of a sudden you can get to 2030, and then maybe you will have a whole wealth of picks. And I think one thing that we've seen in this league is that you might end up suffering through some tougher times. But if you can be one of the teams that stacks up a lot of draft picks, you can change your fortunes very quickly. And you can change your fortunes through landing a great lottery pick. You can change your fortunes through combining a number of those assets and then trading them for a superstar as well. So you are right. It is a little bit further out there in the future, which I think surely has to make the organization a little bit uncomfortable, knowing that they don't have maybe the talent base that they used to have. But I think that's a big part of why they brought Taylor Jenkins in, was, you know, to try to have one of the best coaches on the market and hopefully have someone that can get more than expected out of, let's say, a group of underdogs, a group of young guys.
Eric, I'm going to switch gears here. Warning, we're going to go from sports to feelings. Now, when legends like Brett Favre or Aaron Rodgers left the Packers, some bad blood along the way. What is your sense now of the tone? Since everybody seemed to know this was coming, it doesn't seem to me anyway, Eric, like this is a bad blood kind of situation.
Yeah, man, I think it always turns to that. That's just kind of the internal response we all have to it. But, you know, I wrote this in my initial story about kind of what I learned and what I saw in his years here. And I just think when you walk around downtown Milwaukee, you see the gray 2021 NBA champions hat. You see the white championship t-shirt. You see Bucks green. You see black Bucks shirts. You see people wearing Bucks stuff. And as someone who grew up here, That just wasn't really a thing. It was the Packers, and maybe it was the Brewers a little bit, and certainly it was the Badgers, or if you're in Milwaukee specifically, Marquette. But the Bucks just didn't have that cool factor. People weren't excited to see you on the street and talk to you about the Milwaukee Bucks, and that's what it was like once Giannis ascended to MVP status. And it's kind of cool that it happened. His first MVP year is Mike Budenholzer's first year in Milwaukee. It's the first year in Fiserv Forum. It's all of these things kind of coming together. It's the Deer District being built. It's all of this in Milwaukee where everyone came together, and people are wearing Bucks stuff. When they win a championship, their first one in 50 years, there's 100,000 people in the Deer District. I believe they had to say the estimate was much lower to keep the fire department happy, but I'm telling you, that was 100,000 people outside of that place. And the same thing with the parade. And I just don't know how, even if there are hurt feelings, even if it is going to be sickening for Bucks fans to watch Giannis in a Miami Heat jersey, I just don't think you can get rid of all of those memories. And I don't think you can get rid of all of the good times that everyone here in Milwaukee shared because of the Bucks' greatness, but largely because of Giannis's greatness, because of his ability to take the Bucks to a place that they hadn't been in 50 years. Like, I know there will be hurt feelings, and I know it'll be hard for people to see, but I can't imagine thinking about this as anything other than a really magical time in Milwaukee, and it being because of that man.
And that's a great place to leave it. Eric, thanks a lot for joining us.
Of course, thanks for having me.
That's Eric Names, senior writer for The Athletic, covering the Milwaukee Bucks. We've been talking about the trade deal that ends the Giannis era in Milwaukee. Your reactions, share them with us. Email wisconsintoday@wpr.org.
Coming up on Wisconsin Today, pregnant women serving sentences. A prison doula project in Wisconsin is trying to make sure women have support as they go through an emotionally difficult childbirth.
Giving birth by themselves and giving birth with some form of correctional staff in the room with them.
That's ahead on WPR News. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Last year, the American Civil Liberties Union of Wisconsin successfully sued the State Department of Corrections for not having a program for incarcerated mothers and their infants.
Under a 1991 Wisconsin law, it's been a requirement for the department to have one. The state offers programs for mothers on probation and parole, but not for those who are incarcerated.
The corrections department says it lacks the funding to create a program. But earlier this year, a judge ordered the department to implement one without delay.
Doulas are trying to fill the gaps. Doulas are trained professionals who become an advocate for women during pregnancy, birth, and postpartum.
For the last year, the OSTARA initiative has offered support for pregnant and postpartum women at Wisconsin's jails and prisons. It's called the Wisconsin Prison Birth Project.
Women in the program recently wrote letters about their experience going through pregnancy while incarcerated. Three doulas who work with them, Jasmine, Shanita, and Tracy, read from the letters.
Some of us will not see our babies because of distance or limited resources. Incarceration harms our children. We don't want them to pay for our mistakes.
I constantly feel horrible, and I live in emotional pain filled with worry. I worry that without my love, my baby could die of a broken heart.
My own childhood left me with a broken heart. It feels impossible to heal and grow in prison.
Incarceration for mothers is different than fathers. A part of me has been ripped out of me. My son has now experienced trauma from birth.
What led me to coming here is just getting worse. I feel less than human. I want and need support to be the mother my baby deserves.
There is nothing I want but to hold my children, to be able to love them. My love for my child is a good, alive part of me, but this process and this system feels like they are trying to kill me.
Now, the Ostara Initiative has a proposal for a state program to unite incarcerated mothers and their young children.
Erica Garrity is founder and executive director of the Ostara Initiative. It's a doula-led organization working in correctional systems in 5 states, including here in Wisconsin. Erica, welcome.
Yes, thank you so much for having us.
We just heard the words of some of these women incarcerated, and there are so many facets to a pregnancy. What are some common experiences and challenges that these women face?
Well, for one, I think the majority of the pregnancies are unplanned. So as we're meeting with our clients, participants for the first time, they're reconciling with the idea that they're going to be bringing life into the world in this situation that no one really ever imagined. And that is a lot to get their head around. None of us probably would want this for our child. So that's one of the biggest barriers. And then the very next thing I have heard people say is them needing to accept that they will be doing that without loved ones for the majority of their pregnancy, and giving birth by themselves and giving birth with some form of correctional staff in the room with them, which is pretty unnatural. I don't think any of us who have given birth would choose that for ourselves. So that's a lot for people to try to understand. And then the next part is, currently most people in America who are giving birth will have just 24 hours with their newborn, and then they will face being separated from that infant. And really, from my experience in the last 20 plus years, I think this is one of the most painful things that a person giving birth could experience, is bonding with your child, loving your child, going through the whole process of giving birth, meeting your child for the first time, and then having to say goodbye to your child just within 1, sometimes 2 days.
You have been able to, at times, be in the room for these labor and delivery moments. What is that like? What might a woman want in those circumstances?
Yeah, I think it's pretty universal. It's first and foremost to feel safe. Giving birth is a very physiological, biological process, and it can bring up a lot of vulnerability for all of us, can elicit a lot of joy, a lot of trauma, and needing to feel safe is so foundational to having a safe, healthy birth experience. And that's complicated when you're not in your home environment or with your loved ones, but you're with strangers. So as prison doulas, we have a really unique role to fill this special place in someone's life, where we are providing emotional support, physical support in the place of their loved ones. It's a really big role to fill. And the reason this job even came to be is because a long, long time ago, I was working in a prison, and some of the other women in the prison acknowledged that this was just really scary to go through. And they asked if I would explore creating some kind of a program to support the women going through that, so they wouldn't have to go through that by themselves. So that's when I discovered doula work, a long time ago.
If you are with the woman giving birth and the family can't be there, you're witnessing this moment that is so unique and so special and so filled with emotion.
Mm-hmm.
How do you mark that moment? How do you make sure that, that it happened in some respects?
Mm-hmm. Well, doulas do this very special thing, which is carry the memory of the birth with the mother. So, we're talking about it, processing it, you know, holding her hand, helping her make informed decisions during her labor if she has questions, helping her when she's struggling. We are able to take photos for her, you know, in most of the facilities we work in, so that she can have a memory of what that birth experience was. A lot of people today in America who don't have access to prison doula projects actually don't get pictures of them with their infants. And I've heard some women say it feels like that didn't even happen. Like, there's no evidence, and it's so traumatizing that their brain almost tries to forget it. So we're able to take photos. We're able to really be a resource in the room that reminds everyone that in spite of the circumstances, you know, a life is being born here today and it deserves to be celebrated and honored.
Postpartum time is such a sensitive time for women. What is it like for these women that you work with?
Yeah, these, I think as prison doulas, we would say, you know, the times of separation where infants are removed from their mothers are kind of the worst days of everyone's life. It's very, very grueling work, but it also is, it's just the best work to show up so someone doesn't have to go through that alone and to remind people that they can emotionally survive that and there's something on the other side of that. It's a very hard time for people. It's a very, very hard time for people. And we try to remind people to do really simple things like come out of their cell, please get fresh air, please try to eat, please try to take a shower, have someone you trust that you check in with every day, please come to group. The doulas meet with our clients regularly, and we do screenings for postpartum depression. And we do a lot of educational components in our group about how to prevent adverse perinatal mental health outcomes. So things like journaling, coloring, storytelling, and visiting with your babies, even virtually. They have tablets where they can talk to the children over video. Having people record your voice for your infant to know your voice so that people feel like they're still offering something to their babies and that their babies are still remembering them. That's something that's particularly emotionally painful for people, the idea that their baby will forget them and not know them.
In these roughly 2 hours a week you're spending with these women, what are some ways you're connecting and forming this trust? What are those activities like?
We're going 2 hours a week for the duration of your pregnancy. So we have time to talk very deeply into things like fetal brain development, right? Mm-hmm. So we actually can have pretty deep conversations around what's happening with your baby this week. How do you bond with your baby in utero? What are really healthy food decisions you can make in your pregnancy, even from prison? What are good choices you can make from canteen if you're ordering off of canteen? Because, you know, in prison you have limited food options, but people, even you can use, you know, from a harm reduction perspective, you can make healthier options off of canteen, right? And that is a gift to offer your baby, is to make better food choices. Are you drinking enough water? You know, what are warning signs in pregnancy? A lot of the moms we work with have a history of adverse pregnancy outcomes. So a lot of moms haven't carried babies to term in the past for, you know, all kinds of reasons, but a lot having to do with stress, a lot having to do with poverty. And we're helping people understand, like, how do you stay healthy in your pregnancy? Why is it important to try to get your baby to at least 38 weeks of pregnancy? And we find that people are very interested in that information and very interested in making healthy choices when presented with information.
The State Department of Corrections has not implemented a program to help pregnant and new mothers in prison to have custody of their child for the first year of their lives. But Ostara has come up with a plan for what a program like this could look like in the state prison system. Can you describe what that vision might look like?
Ostara has been looking for a site to pilot what we would like to see as kind of a best-in-the-country model that would serve as an alternative to incarceration for mothers and infants so that people aren't going to even be delivering in custody, but instead are being offered really holistic wraparound services that can help people make good choices in pregnancy, but also can help women get the skills and resources they need to learn about early parenting and healthy attachment with their infants. So, you know, babies only get one beginning to life. Mm-hmm. It's this very, like, ripe, powerful moment in terms of investment in human life. And we believe that if we can create an environment where we can do the absolute most with that, we can prevent really expensive long-term risk and adversity. So our hope is that we could create a community residential living environment where potentially people from jails, community corrections, and even potentially the state prison could be sentenced to as an alternative to incarceration. They could come at any time of their pregnancy and they could stay until their baby's first birthday. And there they would get comprehensive perinatal mental health support, nutritious meals, really quality trauma-informed treatments, and doula care, of course. And the hope would be that we could prevent some of the adversity that we're seeing right now with children's mental health.
The State Department of Corrections has said that they don't have the state funding available to implement a program, you know, in women's prisons. How do you think a program like the one you described would work with the current funding and the current capacity constraints?
Yeah, I'm very curious about how we can build programs with existing resources. So this issue touches on lots and lots of different aspects of our social safety net. And is there a way we could use things like existing infrastructure, we could leverage existing like policies, mechanisms, statutes, funding mechanisms, and bring those things together to try to create something that could work to solve this solution. So, you know, nonprofits have access to funding in the philanthropic landscape. and I think as a nonprofit, we can partner with government entities and different government entities, right? Like some of our biggest funder right now is through the Department of Health in a maternal health innovation grant. So we can draw funding like that the Department of Corrections can't necessarily draw from. So we could take some of that money. We can take some federal funding and bring that to us. And hopefully we could partner potentially with counties or departments of corrections to also patch together in a very creative way long-term funding solutions that would be sustainable and don't have to entirely come from a corrections budget, because this isn't a corrections issue, right? Mm-hmm. This is an infant health issue. This is a child development issue. This is a community safety issue. It's many, many, many things.
Last year, 14 mothers gave birth while serving sentences in Wisconsin. And when you look compared to the general prison population, that's a small mm-hmm. number. Mm-hmm. Why is it so important to focus resources with these 14?
Mm-hmm. Well, first of all, it's two generations at one time. So that's very powerful to focus some resources on that. And instead of thinking about so much resources on so little, I think about the impact of what focusing resources on that small group could truly be, which is very, very significant. I think, you know, we're talking about newborn babies in this situation who absolutely do not have a voice but are so profoundly impacted by some of our systems that are not functioning well right now. And for people who are listening to this story, I think we can easily get frustrated and overwhelmed by what we feel is not working. But there really are vulnerable people that are the generation after us who need us to pay attention and be inspired and have hope that some of these things can be fixed and that we can do better. And I just, I don't want people to get lost in apathy that there aren't potential solutions, because I see every day, even just something simple as the Prison Doula Project, it is not expensive. We get great outcomes and we see positive change from something like that. So in a time where things can feel overwhelming and kind of sad, like, there is always good to be created, and children need that from us. They're being born every day.
What are your next steps toward implementing a program? Where is Ostara at right now?
Yeah, so right now we really have built out a lot of the internal policies of what the programming could look like. We're in relationship with a lot of different providers around the state, and we have started a large-scale major gifts campaign in the state of Wisconsin to raise $4.5 million to acquire a property somewhere within about 30 miles of Madison, where we hope to build the property.
Erica, thank you so much for joining
us. Yeah, you're welcome. Thank you so much for having us. We really appreciate it.
Erica Garrity is founder and executive director of the Ostara Initiative. It's a doula-led organization that supports pregnant and postpartum women in correctional systems in 5 states, including in Wisconsin. When reached for comment, the Department of Corrections said the state legislature declined to fund such a program and refused to expand the system's earned release program. Here is part of that statement, quote, "The practical effect of this is that DOC is required to expand the program to include incarcerated mothers with no additional funding and with no statutory changes that would allow more incarcerated women to take part," end quote. They declined our request for an interview due to ongoing litigation.
Coming up, the Blue Ox Music Festival in Eau Claire has become a summer tradition for bluegrass fans. Hear about the evolution of the festival and the love for this music in Wisconsin.
To be able to contribute this festival to the regional scene, it's something that we've dreamed about doing for so long.
That's next here on WPR News. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
I needed air, so I stepped right out the door. I walked across the path that I'd never seen before.
Over the past decade, the Blue Ox Music Festival in Eau Claire has become a summer tradition for thousands of bluegrass fans from the region and around the country.
The festival was started in 2015 by a Minnesota musician and a campground owner in Eau Claire who teamed up to create a bluegrass, folk, and Americana festival with a Midwest community feel.
Major performers from Nashville headline at Blue Ox, but there are also a lot of Wisconsin musicians in the lineup bringing their own twist on the genre.
Here to talk about this year's fest and the bluegrass scene in Wisconsin, we have Blue Ox co-founder Nate Sipe, mandolin player for Pertnir Sandstone, a roots band out of Minneapolis, and Adam Gruhl, guitarist and vocalist for Horseshoes and Hand Grenades, a bluegrass band from Stevens Point. Nate and Adam, welcome to the show.
Hey, it's great to be here, Rob. Thanks for having me.
And Nate, thanks for being with us.
Absolutely. Glad to do it.
All right, take us back to the origin story, Nate. You and your band are kind of co-founders of Blue Ox. What led this bluegrass and folk and Americana festival to a campground in Eau Claire?
Yeah, well, there was quite a bit of serendipity involved. We happened to be out in Colorado on tour, opening up for the Traveling McCurries, and played through Denver. And we were approached at a merch booth after our set. This gentleman and his son approached us and said, "Hey, we live in Wisconsin. We throw a country festival, and we'd love to have you play sometime." And we sort of said, okay, sounds good. You know, we got a lot of people that approach us and talk big game during our shows occasionally. But this particular man and his son happened to be Jim and Mark Bischel. And we reached out to them following that first encounter. And along with our manager, met up with them, went out, checked out the land, and they had envisioned us trying to do a little bluegrass stage at their big Country Jam USA festival. And we took one look at what's now the Pines Music Park and said, hey, this is perfect for a standalone bluegrass festival. And the more we talked about it, the more it seemed logistically feasible, and it sort of just lifted off from the ground there, and it's been rolling ever since.
And Adam, your band Horseshoes and Hand Grenades played at the first Blue Ox Festival. I think you are a perma band there, right? You've played every show. But take us back to that first year. What was the scene like?
Well, man, you know, we were young. you know, I think this is the 12th year. It becomes a family reunion of sorts. You know, you see your friends grow over time. You see the band grow over time, and you kind of come back. It's almost like a New Year's Eve kind of vibe. You know, you come back, you get to see everybody. You might only see somebody once a year, but it's a great community that gathers around it. You know, obviously such a excellent lineup every year. I mean, it's a ridiculous lineup again this year. So people are amped up to be there, the bands, you know, and the fans. And oftentimes bands, especially regional bands, are able to stick around and enjoy a bunch of the music too, which, you know, it's a joy for us to see what's going on across the country.
And Nate, for you and your band Pertnere Sandstone, does it feel like you got that home field advantage playing here? What's the vibe like doing a show at Blue Ox versus, you know, other shows you might do on the road?
Oh, it's surreal. It's really, I mean, just for us to have, to be able to, you know, contribute this festival to the regional scene. It's something that we've dreamed about doing for so long, and just the way it's rolled out, the way we're able to bring in these national touring acts as well as, you know, the regional, our friends and favorite bands locally. And we're just all intermingling in the campground, at the potluck, picking tunes, backstage, hanging out. It's really a remarkable scene and really a community, you know, and it has been that way. It's had that feel ever since the beginning, just the Wisconsin, the Minnesota, that great, that upper Midwest music scene, and also audience are just very enthusiastic, very into supporting live music. And there's kind of a bit of a void of a festival of this stature in the region. So having this in place, people really gravitated behind it and supported it. And people come in, they look forward to this. As soon as it ends, they look forward to the coming year. Without even knowing the lineup, you know, people trust that it's going to be a great time and bring that enthusiasm.
Adam, you're from Wisconsin. I understand you grew up in Stevens Point, started your band in Point. What was the bluegrass scene in Wisconsin like when you were a teen starting out on your musical career?
Oh, yeah, true blue Scotty through and through, for sure. Yeah, you know, it was there. You know, there was this great festival back in the day called Mole Lake Bluegrass Festival. And when Horseshoes first started, there was something about the band and the energy that the band created that seemed to remind people of that festival. And so, man, people would like bring us t-shirts and stuff, you know, with these great lineups, Nitty Gritty Dirt Band and Newgrass Revival and John Hartford and Bill Monroe, all these acts. So in my opinion, that festival back in the day, Mole Lake Bluegrass Festival, kind of laid the groundwork for something like Blue Ox to occur again. People were hungry for that. So cool. Yeah. When the Bishels and when Pertnere came together to make the festival go off, you know, there was also some really notable acts, one of which is going to be at the festival this year, Art Stevenson and Highwater. You know, mm-hmm. Art has been perpetuating bluegrass and folk music, you know, through the state for so many years, and in a lot of ways helped create a fertile climate for like a lot of young bands like Horseshoes and Hand Grenades to be able to start and make, you know, some degree of a career out of it. But it's actually, you know, it's the scene has been here And certainly it's amplified and continued to blossom because of Blue Ox. And I mean, how, you know, just so grateful that that exists.
And Nate, when people hear the term bluegrass, they might put that geography a little south of here. Is there something unique and distinct about upper Midwest bluegrass?
You know, I always think of the upper Midwest as very DIY. You know, we have those long winters, we get frozen in and we have to keep ourselves warm and entertained. And, you know, the arts has always greatly benefited, I think, from that, you know, kind of isolation. And also we're a bit off the beaten path from a lot of the touring acts, you know, or it's kind of in a lot of people, it's a flyover state. So the upper Midwest, the sound, it's very eclectic as well. You know, I wouldn't necessarily say bluegrass is the main genre. It's kind of a commingling of all kinds of influences that have, you know, we've absorbed from so many great artists historically, like Art Stevenson and High Water is a great example. You know, like we grew up listening to A Prairie Home Companion. So that kind of Western, that sort of swing jazz vibe mixed with bluegrass, it ends up sort of spilling out in a variety of different ways, and which I think is great. You know, you go to a traditional bluegrass festival and very often it's kind of feels like there's a carbon copy of bands that are on stage all day, where at Blue Ox and or just a general festival in the upper Midwest, you have so much eclectic artists that are coming through and bringing their sounds along.
We are talking about the Blue Ox Music Festival taking place in Eau Claire from June 25th to the 27th, and Wisconsin's bluegrass and bluegrass adjacent music scene. Nate Seip is with us from the band Pertnir Sandstone, co-founder of the festival. Adam Gruhl also with us with Horseshoes and Hand Grenades, bluegrass band from Stevens Point. Well, let's name some more names at this festival. Adam had mentioned Art Stevenson. Nate, them Cooley Boys also playing. Tell us a little bit about them.
Yeah, they've been there nearly all of the Blue Ox festivals as well. I think this will be their 11th year, maybe 10th or 11th year. You know, and they've been just great friends of ours. We've been touring with them as long as they've been a band, I think. And, you know, they just recently announced that they're changing their lineup a bit. A couple of the guys are retiring from the stage and I think, you know, focusing on their family life and home life. And so them Cooley Boys is, after this summer, is going to be a bit altered, and hopefully they'll continue going. The Staff Brothers, I know, have got the music in their blood and have, you know, are greatly dedicated to playing tunes. But yeah, the Cooley Boys are going to be, you know, kind of giving their Blue Ox farewell a little bit at this this coming festival.
And Adam, not only are you and Horseshoes and Hand Grenades playing, you also have a new album called Living Room that came out just earlier this year. Give a little listen to the opening track called Fleeting Time.
Fleeting time. Never knew a one who got out of this life. Till a year felt like a month, a week, a day.
Adam, that album title, Living Room, I guess is very literal. You were in a living room recording this one?
Yeah, man, we, you know, you go and you do, you know, in your adventure as a band, you know, we're 15 years old now, actually over 15 years old, almost 16. We, you know, have ventured into these real high techy studios and stuff. And I'm sure Nate would have comments on this that are perhaps similar, but there's something about like getting real comfortable when you're recording and maybe not, you know, being hyper focused on exactly what the gear is and being more so focused on being yourself. And so this time we just went to my house, which is in the hill country of Wisconsin, the Driftless region, and got in a circle, man, and just started making music. And you know, of course, what came out of it was something we were really happy with, because there was fun and love and good energy in the process. And, you know, that kind of the same kind of vibe that we hope to bring to the stage at sweet festivals like Blue Ox.
And then Nate, your band Pertnir Sandstone is also out with an album this year called Side by Side, your ninth album.
step downtown where the sidewalks groan. Poor folks filling in the cracks in the holes.
You've mentioned all the different influences that are coming into the upper Midwest and the bluegrass world. How has your sound evolved over the years?
Well, you know, as Adam was just mentioning, trying to record in a really comfortable, easy way where it's just going to kind of flow and you know, might give you permission to stumble into some new territories. We've always thought of recording as kind of a, you know, a laboratory, so to speak. We have always stretched out and tried to bring in guests and other sounds onto the recorded album that we might not have at our disposal during a live show. We just love recording and getting in there. But this particular album, Side by Side, we really tried to craft as a live album. So in the studio, trying to write tunes that we can pretty directly take to a live performance, and including some new instruments. I started playing lap steel recently and recorded a bit of that on this album, and have worked up the gumption to try doing that on stage live as well. So that's been a fun journey. So I think we're always evolving as songwriters and, you know, just continuing to learn how to use each other's talents to help facilitate our craft.
Bringing things back to Blue Ox, Adam, I think a music festival, yeah, music's part of the story, but the vibe and the feel is big. And you've both hinted at this. Share some of the vibe, the feel that people will get when they attend Blue Ox.
Well, look, it's like a great family-friendly festival. It's the kind of place that allows itself for you to be exactly who you are. You know, you can come with friends, you can come with your family, you can party, you can chill. It's just kind of got the ability for you to do your thing, which I think is great. So, you know, the vibe is incredible. It's this beautiful forest, beautiful grounds, but it's also just super well curated with, you know, a wide-ranging amount of musical genre involved, not just bluegrass, although that's kind of the, you know, the thing that pulls it all together. I've never heard somebody say, oh, golly, I shouldn't have went to Blue Ox. It's always, man, I'm so happy I went to that festival. I can't wait to go again next year.
We'll leave it there. Adam, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having us, man. We love your show, by the way.
It's thank
awesome.
You.
I enjoy it all the time.
Thanks. And Nate, thanks for joining us.
Absolutely. Really excited for this year and hope to see all y'all out at the festival.
That was Nate Sipe, mandolin player from Minneapolis, who co-founded Blue Ox, a bluegrass music festival in Eau Claire, and Adam Gruhl, guitarist and vocalist for the Stevens Point bluegrass band Horseshoes and Hand Grenades. We've been talking about the history of Blue Ox and looking ahead to this year's festival, which runs June 25th through the 27th. We're going out on the song Wisconsin Moon off Horseshoes and Hand Grenades' latest album.
We don't have to worry. We don't need a map. The air is cool and you can smell the pine in that Wisconsin moon. Let it shine, and that Wisconsin moon. Let it shine
Psychologists are reporting a sharp rise in the number of patients turning to AI for mental health advice, for support, and even companionship.
That's according to a survey by the American Psychological Association that found more than 3/4 of psychologists report their patients are discussing AI in therapy.
Ahead of a segment we're putting together on AI companion chatbots, we'd like to know how you feel about chatbots and mental health. Have you turned to a chatbot for mental health advice or companionship? How did it go? Did you feel supported? Are there unexpected harms or vulnerabilities that concern you?
Email us at wisconsintoday@wpr.org, or you can call or text to get in touch. The number is 888-642-0232. That's 888-642-0232.
Well, Wisconsin Today producers include Trevor Hook, Beatrice Lawrence, and Rochelle Wilson.
Our technical directors are Tyler Ditter and Brad Kohlberg.
Learn more about us at wpr.org/Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to WPR News.